If you'd like to come in and take your seats, this is session 2C, I think. 2D. Okay, there we go. Contemporary issues in private health insurance. Hey, Chris. If you'd like to come forward as much as possible, Ben's going to do something a little bit different. He's going to do a short presentation and actually leave a lot of time for discussion. And to facilitate that, it'd be really good if we're all together so we can pass the roving mic around and kind of learn from the collective wisdom of the people in this room. So if you could bunch up, that would be terrific. So our presentation today is going to be led by Ben Uy. Ben's a consulting private health insurance actuary working at DB and Actuaries. He's done this presentation actually many times before. I think this is probably his third or fourth attempt. And we're really keen to see this to be a really active discussion afterwards. So without further ado, Ben Uy.
So I'm going to run through, I guess, issues in health insurance. So I'm not going to give you solutions, but it's a bit of a CPD thing for people who may not know about health insurance. For those who are practicing health insurance, there's not going to be many groundbreaking discoveries today. So I'll try and keep it to about half an hour, 40 minutes, and then we'll have some discussion towards the end. And this assumes that people understand health insurance to some extent. So just to go through what I'm going to cover today, I'm going to start off with some background, very quick, high-level background, and then we're going to move on to consumer issues, and then insurer issues, and what actuaries are doing in this space, and then a bit of outlook. So we just start with some really high-level background. So stakeholders, there are 34 health funds, lots of players, hospitals, doctors, et cetera. Over half the population has health insurance. Actuaries, obviously, are stakeholders, as well as a whole range of regulators, FIAC, EPRA, Ombudsman, Health Minister, et cetera. As a snapshot, the health insurance are quite fragmented. You've got some really large insurers, and the biggest two, Medibank, Bupa, they make up over half the market share, if you like. And then the top five, including Medibank, Bupa, they're about 80% of the market share. And beyond that, you have a whole range of really small or restricted or not-for-profit insurers. So I won't dwell on that too much because this is not really new territory. In terms of just products, there's hospital cover and there's extras cover. You can get different varieties by, levels of cover. You can buy in components, you can buy as a package. Some are a bit more adventurous these days. Some might cover GP services or have, loyalty initiatives built into it. General treatment products can, have a range of benefits. It could be either a dollar amount or percentage back. So there's generally a lot to choose from. In terms of policyholders, which are, I guess, quite an important part of health insurance, people. Overall, it has been growing, and it's been growing faster than population growth. In terms of which funds are growing, a lot of smaller funds tend to be growing much faster than their market share of growth. So they're winning market share from the bigger insurers. There are quite a lot of single policyholders out there, and the biggest age segment is the sort of young family segment, if you like. Numbers. So actuaries like numbers, so I'll throw some numbers there. It's a $20 billion premium industry, of which the margins are quite small. It's about 4% net margin, net insurance margin. The gross margin's 12.6 FY14. And so you can see that that's a trend of, margins declining for the last couple of years and expenses are coming down. Rate increases have been about 5 to 6% for the last couple of years. So just gives you a bit of a snapshot about financial results. There's a whole lot more slides in the appendix, so, feel free to use it as a reference later on, but I'm not going to cover all that in detail today. From a capital point of view, we had new capital standards come in 2014, and that released some capital requirements. So that meant that excess capital, capital in excess of capital requirements have increased. So capital, I guess being actuaries like to talk about capital. So I've just got a quick graph to show net assets on premium. So it was increasing at one stage, and but now declining a little bit just because there's a range of insurers converting to for-profit and dividends being paid out. Again, just very quickly mentioning that we had new capital standards last year, so that meant a new capital adequacy standard, new solvency standard, and a range of policies such as capital management plans from 1 July last year. So health insurance is a very busy space. There's a lot of developments. I'm not going to go through every single thing on that list. That's just probably too much, and that's going to take the whole session by itself. The first one, you know, I think has quite a large impact on the industry, which is the plans to close FIAC and transfer its functions to APRA. We had Medibank list. We've got a few new entrants, changes to the MLS and rebates. There's a trend of, you know, downgrading products. Cash rates really low. So I'll come back to some of these points later on. So I want to start off, I guess this is the main crux of the presentation, health insurance issues. So I want to start off with consumer issues, you know, and break down consumer issues into, I guess, purchasing issues and then claiming issues, just to make it a bit more bite-sized. So I think affordability is very topical. We just had the rate increases 1 April, and the media likes to talk about affordability. So it's quite a big issue, I think, in terms of premiums, and this is often left out of the equation. They always talk about rate increases, but actual premiums itself is quite a big number. So I've put up a graph of some extreme examples. These are top package products for a family. Annual premiums before rebate. So you've got, you know, basically just below $8,000 to nearly $10,000 a year. So I think that's quite a big amount. And if you project that out at 6% for the next 10 years, that could be, you know, $14,000, for example. That's the price of a small car. So I think affordability is a big issue. So luckily, I guess the government provides some support by giving policyholders a rebate. The rebate is complex. You've got 30% reducing to 29%, which is now 27.8%. It varies by age. It varies by income band. And then on top of that, the rebate amount, you know, it's indexed to CPI, the dollar amount. And so a rate increase in excess of CPI, therefore, is borne by the policyholder. So, again, this is adding to affordability issues because the rebate is not captured in rate increases. So a member will get a letter. It'll say your total rebate is now this, is lower. Your total out-of-pocket has gone up. But that's not picked up in the 6% headline increase. So there are quite a few issues with the rebate. The way it's set up, the income bands are frozen for a number of years, so that means that as salary increases, policyholders will creep up to the next income band and therefore have a lower rebate, so again, bad for affordability. Same as the people who are earning less than $90,000, they're going to get hit at some point when the income exceeds $90,000 affordability or pay the price of, you know, the surcharge if they don't take out health insurance. So, you know, what are the options if you think affordability is an issue and you have, like, you know, a budget to work to? You can downgrade. You can cut benefits. So I've put up some examples for the same four sample funds. You know, here are some, again, extreme examples. These are sort of low-cost, high access package products for a family. And you see the gap in the price is huge. So there's a lot of possible downgrade options available. Obviously, not everyone's going to downgrade because, you know, if you're unwell, you will value your cover and therefore it's not an option. But if you're quite healthy, so you decide that you no longer need obstetrics cover or you don't really need hips and knees, you can, you know, play around with the products and just downgrade. So I think downgrading is actually a big issue because it will drive, I guess, more out of pockets. And often out of pockets are unexpected out of pockets, and so you get complaints and, you know, unhappy customers, and the media takes advantage of that and beats up the health insurance industry. So in general, it's actually quite a big issue. On top of that, insurers seem to be responding for that need for that lower cost product. So there's a vicious cycle happening where insurers will create cheaper products and people will demand cheaper products, and there's a bit of a vicious cycle happening. In terms of just downgrades, the trends, so I've got a little graph to show the number of people on policy with either excess or exclusion. And the red line is an example of number of exclusionary products. You can see it's just sort of, you know, increased dramatically. And at December, only 13% of all hospital products have no exclusions, no restrictions, no excesses. So, you know, a vast majority have some saving built into the product. So the financial impact of downgrades, it's about roughly about 1% loss in revenue for the last couple of years. And another way of looking at downgrades is, you know, if you express average premium as a proportion of average weekly earnings, it's currently stable, just below 2%. And so that shows that even though rate increases are going up, people are finding ways of saving money to keep in line with their household budgets. So the other, I guess, big consumer issue I have is that, you know, when making a claim, there are issues with the benefits. They are very complex. So when you read, you know, the brochures, it will say you're covered for this and that, but when you actually go to a hospital, it's actually quite a different story. So you've got, you know, different fees. You've got doctor's fees. You've got accesses. You've got benefit limitation periods, exclusions, non-agreement hospitals, etc. So it's a bit of a minefield. So people reading brochures, they probably don't fully understand the products. And after a few years of not reading the brochure, it'll be even more difficult to remember what you signed up for. So all this complexity, I think people just generally say, you know, what am I out for? What are my out-of-pockets? So out-of-pockets, I don't think they're very well tracked. So there are numbers reported by FIAC, and you can see that out-of-pockets, as a proportion of hospital benefits, they look like they're coming down. But that's because the excess is capped at $500, for example, and it's not indexed. And so it's a proportion of benefits. It's actually looking lower over time. But the picture is not complete. It doesn't include, I guess, benefits which are not included in the product. So excluded benefits, for example, don't show up in the reporting. And so you don't really see the full impact of all that. So like I said before, out-of-pockets tend to be unexpected, and so you get unhappy customers, and that normally means you get complaints. And so the last couple of years, the number of complaints to the ombudsman have increased. They mostly relate to benefits. So I think lower-cost products add to this problem because it just means that you get really complex products. People don't understand or are engaged with the products, and so they complain. There's also an increasing trend of intermediaries, brokers, aggregators, and so that, you know, indicates that people need help in choosing the products because it's just a difficult task. The issue of complaints, I think a lot of that can be sort of summarized into inappropriate motivation. You've got two groups of people, really. So one spectrum, on one end, you have people who are forced to buy health insurance for whatever reasons, tax, penalties, MLS, lifetime health cover. And then you have people who really value the cover. So the people who are forced into buying health insurance tend to be, you know, less loyal, they're price-driven, probably more vocal. You know, they'll tweet about their bad experience or they'll complain about prices. So combining, I guess, purchasing issues and claiming issues, you get sort of value for money. Is it value for money? There's a lot of perception that we have a free hospital system, free health system called Medicare. There are a lot of perceptions that health insurance can just cover everything. Why am I getting out of pockets? There's a sense of entitlement that, you know, you should get some return, you know, to go and claim your glasses or whatever, which is quite a funny mindset because no one goes around saying, oh, I didn't have a flood this year, therefore my house insurance wasn't value. So the value of, you know, of health insurance is a bit of an interesting one. So I think it's really important to sort of look at, you know, are we creating cheap products that don't really fit the purpose or the promise of health insurance or insurance in general? So I think to sort of try to answer, you know, value for money, my personal circumstance, you know, my partner had kidney cancer 2 years ago, and we went through the process of going to, you know, see a consultant, get a doctor, whatever. Where health insurance was really valuable was that we were able to access private specialists a lot quicker. So if we had gone through the public system, we would have waited 3 months to just get an initial consult to work out what is wrong, whereas the specialist was able to see us in a week. You get that sort of, you know, clarity of what to do next. And the public system was basically saying you lose a kidney and that's it, that's your only option, whereas the private specialist was able to save the kidney. So for my mind, it was incredibly good value for money because you got better access, quicker access, you got better outcomes in the end. And sure, there was an out-of-pocket because the doctors charged because they were excess of the gap scheme for the medical part, but it was an incredible, you know, value for money in my mind. So the next thing I want to talk about is insurer issues. So sustainability is a really sort of key issue I think all insurers are worried about, and retaining that value proposition and relevance to consumers, you know, has got to be up there. And therefore, consumer issues are insurer issues, you know. Other things that board members seem to be thinking about is, you know, how to stay ahead of the game. How do we make sure we are more relevant than other insurers? Do we have to be bigger? You know, do we have to keep growing? What else do we have to do differently to attract members or keep our members? So sustainability is quite a big thing, and community rating is, I guess, the central glue that holds health insurance together. And risk equalization is the mechanism of achieving community rating. So we heard earlier from the prior session that Andrew and Peter's session that risk equalization is probably not sustainable in its current form and needs a bit of work to improve it. So risk equalization, for those who don't know, it's a mechanism that subsidizes between different risks. So, you know, young people effectively pay for older people. So I guess the issues here are, you know, there are a lot of product designs out there which probably dilute community rating. You know, do we need to look at that? Should we have minimum benefits, for example, or a standardized product? So the pool has increased, you know, 7.5-8% for the last couple of years. So is that going to be affordable in the future, effectively? So there's a lot of calls to review it, move to a different system, allow some sort of risk rating, perhaps. So I don't know the solution today, but it's something that we have to look at. So in terms of just, you know, something different, I thought I'd just put up, you know, who pays and who receives from the pool, and NIB is a big payer, and they're very vocal about that, and you got, you know, Bupa and Medibank receiving a lot of the money from NIB, for example. So it's a zero-sum game, and it's very political. So there'll be winners and losers. So therefore, to change the system will require a lot of, you know, political will. Someone has to just, you know, do it or force it, because to get industry consensus would be quite difficult. So I thought I'd just put up an example on risk equalization. You know, there's a lot of talk about let's perhaps introduce a bit of risk rating. What if you were to charge differently for people who smoke or don't look after themselves? What I've got here is just a simple example of, say, let's make low-cost products cheaper by $190, for example. Just keep it simple. To achieve that, it would mean that comprehensive products, you know, products for older people will have to go up by $500 to compensate for that. So is that really going to fly with consumers? You know, will that be an outcome that people are, you know, happy with? So these are the issues, I guess, that you as actuaries have to deal with, I guess. So, the third sort of big thing, I guess, for insurers is financial pressures. There's a lot of pressure on premiums being low for various reasons, the minister, media, competition. But there are also a lot of cost pressures, and cost pressures can come from, you know, just technology, hospitals, contracts. But I think what a lot of media outlets and a lot of people don't really understand is that there's an increase in general health awareness from the Australian public. People are just more aware, you know, with Google, you can talk to people, you can find out more. And so they're all expecting better health outcomes. And that's driving more usage of health insurance. And that's quite a big driver. So just to illustrate the point, I've got a graph for benefit inflation, hospitals. The green part is the volume component, you know, people using it more. And so it's quite a big part. And whereas for extras, general treatment products, it's not so bad because you can control that using limits and benefit structures. Whereas in hospital, it's like a buffet. You don't really cap the number of times you go to the hospital. You can go as many times as you like. Which is a bit of a side note I want to bring up. So I was really annoyed by an article in the Fin Review where they compared rate increases to CPI. And CPI is an index that compares the price of a good this year versus last year. So it's just a price increase. Whereas premium rate increases include the volume increases. So it's like I said, a buffet. You go 50 times. That is picked up by the premium rates, and therefore the premium rate increases. So other financial pressures insurers are faced with, strategy, capital management plans, shareholder returns, et cetera. So I won't touch on that too much. Keep going, create time for discussion. The fourth biggest risk, issue for insurers is sovereign risk, and there are a lot of sovereign risks around. And I'm not saying health insurance is the most it's an insurance area with the most sovereign risk. There are plenty of other industries with a lot of sovereign risk, but there are changes coming. You know, FIAC is going to close and become APRA. Will that happen in time? Don't know. We've got changes to the rebate. Government can just impose policy without consultation, like the budget last year. But there's also a lot of environmental changes. You know, Medibank is now a listed company. Should they decide to start a price war, what's that going to look like? We have new entrants, you know, primary healthcare bought out transport health, so that's a new thing. We've got members-owned health funds, a collective group of small health funds, not-for-profit health funds coming together to sort of, try to work like as if the industry super funds took on all the other super funds, you know, come together as a not-for-profit. So other changes, I guess, things like the cash rate being really low, that's also an issue. So the actuarial role, all these issues, you know, the appointed actuary came in 10 years ago. The appointed actuary is responsible for the FCR and pricing, and we have notifiable circumstances. So the appointed actuary is quite heavily involved with a lot of health insurers for all aspects of the business. HBC is very focused on health insurance. I guess, you know, HBC members here can talk to that a bit more later. So my view on challenges for actuaries and health insurance is fairly similar to other practice areas, to make sure we are still valuable and making sure actuaries are strategic and, you know, technical and try to within the framework of the appointed actuary, but at the same time be more business focused as well. Risk management standards coming out potentially in the next 24 months, who knows how that's going to work. So for health insurers and particularly, I think appointed actuaries and actuaries should try to help solve the sustainability issue. And something I'd like to throw out there, and this question is asked almost every contemporary private health insurance issue workshop in the last decade, is do we have the right number of health actuaries in this space? What are your thoughts? You know, so in summary, I guess the key themes I have for consumer and insurer issues are affordability, you know, premiums, are they going to be under control anytime soon? Sustainability, can risk equalization keep going the way it is? And fitness for purpose, is the product so watered down that it's no longer viewed as insurance? You know, is that a bad thing? And all these issues, they're all linked. So just looking out the horizon a little bit, longer term, I think community rating needs a bit of a review or rethink. You know, do we need to have a bit of risk rating perhaps, or you know, to work out what we should equalize, how we should do it. And then the next point I had was, instead of asking whether the market is competitive, maybe we should ask whether policyholders are engaged enough, or, you know, how do we get better engagement so that they understand the products better instead of you know, freaking out when they get out of pocket. Should health insurers play a larger role in health outcomes, not just be a funder? So we've seen some of that already with Medibank Bupa, but, you know, should health insurers try and be in that space where they influence the health outcomes and therefore the health insurance premium? Is it managed care? Don't know. On the shorter term, my sort of short-term radar for the next couple of months is the transition of FIAC to EPRA. I think that's going to be a bit of a game changer, just because the culture is a bit different and we're going to lose the wonderful FIAC people. I'm sucking up here. So, and then the pricing round beyond that in September and October onwards, you know, how's that going to work with EPRA coming out saying that they're not really in the policy game. So, you know, the reversion back to the Department of Health, how's that going to affect health insurers? Risk management standards, the CPS 220 from EPRA, I think that's going to be an area that actuaries can get involved with. There's talk about deregulating the pricing round and price and premium setting in general. How's that going to work? Are insurers allowed to reprice many times? At any time, and then primary health networks, how's that going to play out? What are health insurers doing in that space? So I've gone through a lot of issues very quickly, and I don't have any solutions for you today, but I think actuaries can contribute a lot to the discussions. So that's over to you guys.
So Ben has very generously given us 20 minutes of his presentation time, which he could have spent riding his high horse, but we're going to use his time as a discussion. We'd like to keep the discussion on the record, so if you could please have a microphone when you ask your question. And we don't want the questions just to go from the floor to Ben, but to go around the group. We have a lot of people, a lot of knowledge about the health insurance industry. We have the regulator, we have corporate, we have consulting represented here, and we kind of want to have that collective wisdom shared in this forum. So does anyone like to go first with a question on affordability, sustainability, and make sure I get a microphone to you?
Ben, thanks for that. Another great summary for another year or so. Paul Groenewegen from FIAC, for those who don't know me. I was wondering about, you had a slide that detailed kind of consumer issues. And it identified a number of things. Nearly there. But what I was wondering was, isn't one of the big issues for consumers the complexity that is health, and how that extends into private health insurance, into a myriad of products, as well as the complexities around the interaction of private health insurance and the broader health system, which we don't often hear enough about. But I was wondering, what role do you see, or indeed does anyone see, in terms of helping people to navigate that, you know, quite opaque space, either for insurers or actuaries?
I think insurers can play a big part, because often if you have a health issue, well, my experience was we rang up the health fund and said, you know, what do we do? What's the next step? We spoke to GPs and they all gave us sort of wishy-washy answers of, you know, try this, try that. Ultimately, I got the best advice from my brother who's a doctor, and we were led on that path after that. But I think health insurers can play a part, because you ring up and say, you know, am I covered? What do I do? So, yeah, the navigation throughout the health system is really difficult. It's very complex. This is probably a big area that I think insurers can add value, and that's how, you know, you can stay ahead of your competitors, by saying, let's have a service where gives you a bit of a roadmap. Here's what you should expect. These are the questions you should ask. You should get, you know, these things looked at. Have a bit of a checklist. Have someone guide you through that process. So we really don't have that at the moment, I think. So it's sort of based on word of mouth / Googling yourself, plus, you know, just fear driving your actions at the moment. So, yeah, I totally agree that that's something that insurers can look at, and maybe, you know, other groups, advocates.
Does anyone else want to have a go at that? Thinking about how insurers or actuaries might get involved in navigating the complexities of the health system? Or indeed any other question from Ben's presentation?
Brett.
Brent Walker. Some of you might know I've been in working in the health system for a long, long time now. 1974 was when I started, and as the actuary of HCF. One of the achievements which was not appreciated by the rest of the industry at the time, this was in 1976 and 77, was that I persuaded private hospitals to charge for what they did, rather than just charge for the time the patient was in the hospital, you know, a bed day charge. And the rest of the industry thought I was crazy to suggest something like that. Now, of course, we've got an incredibly complex charging system in the private sector, and hospitals do basically charge for what they do. But it doesn't exist in the public sector. And I'm wondering, why not? You know, I've been suggesting it should happen in the public sector for probably the last 30 years or more, but it still hasn't happened. Shouldn't we as a profession be actually agitating for that? I know it's against our interest for the private health funds, because the health funds will pay more, but if you can set up the competition between public hospitals and private hospitals on an equal basis, then I think the whole system would work better and people would understand it better as well.
I'll take that as a comment.
It's too hard. That's Richard Hurley from the Department of Health. I take slight issue with that, Brent, because I work in public hospital financing, and we've got an activity-based funding system up and running as we speak, and have had since 2011. So everything is charged according to the case mix of the procedure. You know, as far as financing goes, the Commonwealth pays according to the case mix of the complexity, according to the actual procedures that were carried out. Okay, so that's more of an issue to negotiate between the hospitals, isn't it, with the funds, I suppose. Yeah. Oh, it's about to change again. As soon as we introduce something, we're changing. Okay, point taken.
Would you like to make any reflections on your work as an actuary in the department?
I guess it's often sort of telling secrets out of session, but I guess it's frustrating sometimes sort of being in the policy environment of the Department of Health where, although there's a lot of rhetoric around evidence-based policy, the reality is often driven by political expediency. And so I work with consultant actuaries, health actuaries, and they say to me sometimes, you know, how can we best put our position up on a case? And I say, well, whatever you do, do it quickly, because there's a small window of interest as far as the minister is concerned, and then they'll be on the next issue. And that, I think, has been the overriding story of my 10 years in the public service, that I often get very frustrated and thinking, you're not, from a policy perspective, looking at the complexity of this work at all, or the underlying drivers of cost. You just want to make a quick political decision. Everything's driven by the short political cycle, and it's very, very frustrating having a foot in both camps.
Thanks, Richard. Does anyone else have any other questions for the group?
Yep. This may be a comment, not a question. I think the last point's what is my out-of-pocket is what it all comes down to. All other insurance that I can think of, you know what you're going to be out-of-pocket if you make a claim. You've got a preset excess if you make a claim. Basically, when you're paying premiums for your private health insurance, it's just an invitation to fork out more money at some stage in the future if you decide to use your insurance, but you don't know how much that will be, which I think sort of defeats, well, the claim purpose of private health insurance, which is to take pressure off the public system. I think Canberra's a case in point. I think we have the highest rate of private health insurance coverage in the country and the lowest rate of usage. I think that goes to... And so, obviously, it's not really taking the burden off the public system that it's designed to. And you can't, because you're going to have people... Of course, plenty of people still have their private health insurance and use the public system. Probably childbirth is a good example. We've got colleagues who have gone in under private and public, have paid thousands of dollars under private, had poor service, and have gone in under public, not paid a thing, and had great service. It just goes to the sustainability of the current system, especially when you have, well, at the moment, low wages growth, or forecast low wages growth, and private health insurance premiums continuing to increase 2-3 times that. There doesn't seem to be a lot of talk about... Like, there just seems to be a lot of fiddling around the edges. You know, let's reduce this benefit, let's take this off PBS or something. There needs to be, a real review of... And it would be a controversial one, I assume, and maybe that's why it's not done. The whole health system, because as it stands, from what I can see, it comes down to that bottom point, and that bottom point is what's making it unattractive, because I don't really think... Well, I think we're probably at saturation point in terms of getting people into private health insurance, which is why the private health insurers have a hard time perhaps making leeway through the market, getting increase in their membership. But I just... For me, it comes down to that bottom point, and that bottom point is the main issue.
Thanks, Tristan. Does anyone else want to make a comment or put a question to Ben, put a question to the group? This is your chance to be provocative.
My name is Min. I'm relatively new to the health industry, so I'm allowed to ask stupid questions, hopefully. My question is, isn't the problem here with the providers? Is there an issue here with, for example, with the previous question around, well, are the providers providing a good enough service to justify private people forking out for private health insurance hospitals and therefore, you know, paying for the private health insurance? And my other question, and this might be a stupid one, but are we paying doctors too much? And is that what's driving the costs, cost increases? Because none of us working health insurance are driving around in fancy red Ferraris, but I have some doctor friends that recently purchased Ferraris. So, you know, is that the crux of the issue? And I know it's controversial, but can we tackle that instead?
I think I might respond to that a little bit and say that one of my slides basically said that there's an increased demand of, you know, better health outcomes from the population. People are demanding, you know, this and that. I've read about this procedure, or I've heard about that prosthesis, whatever. So it's I think the population as a whole has sort of shifted towards, I want a better outcome. So they might go and see a doctor to get a treatment done today, but they might not have done that 20 years ago because they, you know, were less informed. So I think the volume part is probably the part we have to address, because cost, you can impose say a freeze on the many benefit schedule, and so doctors theoretically their cost is capped. But if people decide to go see the doctor five times more than before, you know, you can't stop that. It's all about the patient using it more. And that's a bit of a shift that there's no quick answers, because how do you stop people from wanting better health outcomes? You know, so once you're informed, you just want the best. You want to solve it and get your life back. So that is actually quite a big driver, I think. You know, everything else, cost increases, you can contract for it, you can put limits, you can set up structures and systems, but people will always want better health outcomes and live forever, or live a much, you know, better life. So that's hard to control and manage, I think.
Hayden Burno. So the theme of this summit is take the lead. I was trying to apply that to your three themes. I was looking at the affordability one. And you put some great graphs up there showing how much the 6% yearly benefit inflation is attributable to the volume factor. And can we take the lead in improving the discussion on that factor by promoting a better measure of inflation that maybe excludes the volume part? And so a sign that we would have done a good job would be that yearly newspaper article that you hated would suddenly have that factor in it, that part of this is that people are using these services more. And if we did a basket of goods inflation measure, it's actually only 2 or 3%.
Next one, does anyone have any good metrics out there or alternative ways of thinking about benefit inflation? Maybe too big a question to ask this early, but certainly something to think about and continue the conversation on. Ben put a question to the group about the number of actuaries in the industry. Maybe that's an open question, but what about the value that actuaries bring? Does anyone want to share a story of something that they've been doing either in a corporate or a consulting company where they really think that actuaries are doing something different and are bringing value to their employer, to the company that they're working with?
Trent? Brendan? I'll pick people.
I'm going to stick in front of you.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Nick. This is why my employer's not here to validate whether I am adding that value or not. I guess as private health insurers getting involved more broadly than purely private health insurance. So there's a number of insurers that are providing, actually becoming a player in health services. So that's an area that, in my case, I'm coming to terms with elements there that I haven't dealt with in the past, and new experiences and so forth. And somewhere that an area that actuaries can potentially add some value along with other professionals.
Thanks, Nick. I suppose one observation that I make within the organisation I work in, they're certainly partly given that Medibank has recently listed, but also on the other hand, I think management being held to a, you could call it a high level of accountability. They've sought advice to support their decisions, and I think the actuarial team that I work in, that certainly expanded in the past year, year and a half. That's in recognition of probably the additional value that we can add. I think there's been a lot more questions being asked more recently within the organisation, certain pricing decisions, certain product design questions, and there have actually been actual business outcomes or business decisions as a result of that. So I think certainly actuaries or vocal actuaries can contribute a lot to any organisation.
Well, thank you all for your contributions. Maybe one last chance before I pass the podium back to Ben.
Yep. Okay, I'm going to be really controversial now. In 1976, when I designed Medibank Mark II for the Liberal government, I introduced the concept of what I called reinsurance. And I called it reinsurance on purpose because if I'd called it risk equalisation, it wouldn't have got through. Malcolm Fraser would have never understood the term, and nor would have Ralph Hunt, who was the Minister of Health. But secondly, we couldn't have had a risk equalisation system at that stage because not every health fund even had a computer. So they didn't, and many of them just didn't really know too much about their membership at all. So the concept of risk equalisation was just not possible in 1976. But I've in the last 40 years, I still haven't resolved from the fact that it should be a risk equalisation system. And the Productivity Commission in 1997 recommended that the industry move to a risk equalisation system. We still haven't got it, and I must say, sorry, FEAC, but I think it's FEAC's discredit that we don't have a risk equalisation system now, because I think there was opportunities, and we squimped. Now, the question is, and I'd love to see actuaries answer this, when are we going to get one? Is it going to be before I retire? Because I'm not going to retire until we get one. So there's an incentive for you to get me out of the place and get a risk equalisation system in.
Thanks, Brent. Well, why don't you put your hands together for Ben Uli and...
Thank you.